Let's start this episode with a little time travel. We're going to go all the way back to 2012. You might remember that K-pop sensation Gangnam Style has taken over global radio waves. I mean, everybody is doing that dance. But that's not the only thing that's happening. There's also climate stuff going on. Lots of fossil fuel developments. BP is still cleaning up the Deepwater Horizon spill from 2 years earlier. The Canadian tar sands are kicking up renewed interest. Oh, and Shell plans to move forward on a new project, Arctic oil exploration. In hindsight, it seems kind of crazy that folks would be drilling for new oil in the Arctic a decade ago. But the Arctic is estimated to hold about 13% of the world's undiscovered oil and 26% of undiscovered gas. Big oil's not about to miss out.
Shell was the first of many that were lining up. You know, Equinor was planning to go into the US Arctic. Chevron was looking at the US Arctic. We felt that Shell would be the opening of the gates into that frontier.
That's Louise Rouse. At the time, Louise was a young consultant working for a nonprofit called Share Action when her team got a daunting request to try and block Shell from opening those gates in the Arctic. They weren't climate scientists or even protesters. They worked with investors, including ones who owned shares of Shell. Louise's job was twofold: convince investors that Shell's Arctic exploration was a big financial risk, and get them to persuade Shell's management to halt the project.
The story the industry was telling at that time was that frontier exploration, big mega projects, was going to be the future of the industry. And we wanted to challenge that. We felt that if we could challenge that growth narrative that the industry was selling, then we could actually sort of attack the foundational beliefs about the oil industry in the market and the future that investors thought might exist for the market. And the Arctic became one of the major frontiers that the industry was looking to exploit.
So Louise and her team repackaged climate change in a more investor-friendly way. They argued that the potential for oil spills was financially risky, that the Russian energy company Shell was negotiating with for drilling access had an irresponsible history. Shareholders who simply stood by would be playing roulette with their own millions of dollars in stock. But convincing them was a long and uphill battle.
There was a sense of resignation, I would say, among investors early on around the Arctic. One of our first meetings with an investor in London, they listened to the points we were making, and then they said, a progressive investor who I think on a personal level wasn't in favor of Arctic drilling, but professionally said, you know, it's inevitable. The most we can do is sort of manage the risk.
But in 2015, after spending a whopping $7 billion on exploration, Shell abandoned the project, citing safety concerns and federal permitting problems.
When Shell left the Arctic, I wrote to some investors just to thank them for their work. And one wrote back to say, well, it was inevitable. So that arc of inevitability had shifted completely.
It was a huge win. And later in 2015, the Paris Agreement struck another blow to the future of big oil. And waves of big corporations started making net zero climate commitments in line with global 1.5 degree targets. But that didn't mean they'd actually stick to those goals. Louise has spent the years since teaming up with investors to push corporations for climate accountability. And her work is far from over.
This is A Matter of Degrees, stories for the climate curious. I'm Dr. Leah Stokes.
I'm Dr. Catherine Wilkinson.
And I'm Dr. Pasha Madhavi.
We got a lot of doctors in the house today.
Yeah, and I don't think any of us could do surgery.
Yeah, probably not.
Instead, what we're going to be talking about is corporate climate commitments. And Dr. Pasha Madhavi is a professor like me at UC Santa Barbara, where he also researches energy policy.
Well, I'm glad to be here. And I'm really glad that you ended up convincing me to move to Santa Barbara. It's probably like 10 degrees in DC right now.
Good life choice all around.
So Pasha, tell us about the research you've been doing lately.
So my colleagues and I looked at the biggest oil and gas companies in the world and compared what they said they would do on climate to what they would actually do on climate. And those things did not line up. I mean, there's been an explosion of pledges in recent years. If you think back to 2019, only 16% of the global economy had made a net zero pledge. But by 2021, in just 2 years, almost 70% had made a commitment.
Wow, that is a huge jump. And I imagine there are lots of folks who think that's a really good thing that these pledges have grown.
Well, yeah, but there's just one teeny tiny problem. A lot of those pledges are meaningless.
While we're seeing all these statements, we're also recognizing that a lot of this is greenwashing. There are pledges that might look really good on paper, but they do very little to actually lower carbon pollution in any time frame that we know is necessary.
And I do feel like a lot of these things come with very swanky websites about net zero goals, Paris aligned. But I know recently there was that Shell memo that came out that read, and I quote, "Please do not give the impression that Shell is willing to reduce carbon dioxide emissions to levels that do not make business sense." So net zero on the one hand, actually not going to do anything on the other.
Exactly. And what's kind of wild is that Shell's done a lot better than other companies like Chevron and Exxon.
Wow, that's depressing. So Pasha, how do we actually tell what's bold from BS?
The first thing we need to unpack is what categories of heat-trapping pollution that these companies are counting. Every company has three different scopes of emissions, sometimes thought of as burn, buy, and beyond. So let's say I run a bakery. Scope one means all the emissions I directly burn and control, like the gasoline for my delivery cars or the amount of gas that I use to heat my ovens.
Okay, I'm following. So you're trying to make some croissants. So that's all the pollution associated with making the croissants and getting them to the people.
Exactly. Scope two is all the emissions I buy for my business. So I don't have total control over these. It's kind of like the electricity that I pay for to power my bakery.
Okay, and what about like the pollution for the wheat that you had to buy to, you know, bake that croissant?
So all of that is put into scope three. All the indirect emissions that are completely beyond my bakery, but things that we still need to make a loaf of bread. So it's fertilizer, it's used to grow the wheat, flour, it's methane from uneaten leftovers from a landfill. I mean, these emissions might not even be directly related to the croissant either. Like if my employees' retirement plans are invested in other companies that are emitting greenhouse gases.
This is a very progressive bakery where you're giving retirement plans to your employees, Pasha.
I know. I'm actually wondering if you might be hiring anytime soon. And is there a monthly croissant stipend also? I'd like to know about that. So we've got scope one, the things you're burning within the bakery. Scope two, things that you're buying for the bakery. Scope three, happening well beyond the bakery, but still related. So let's take it from bakery to a company like Shell. Their scope three emissions then would include things like the gas that people are buying at the pump, right? Or the jet fuel that gets used for airplanes.
Yeah, exactly. Scope three amounts to somewhere around 90% of all Shell's emissions. And it's not just the case for fossil fuel companies. I mean, the vast majority of most companies' emissions are scope three in this beyond category. They're also the most difficult kind to measure.
And I have to imagine that means a lot of companies just don't measure them. Like, how can we possibly quantify and be responsible for the emissions of our customers?
Sadly, yes. Many climate commitments only include plans and measurements for scope one and two. And remember how I said Shell is unique? Mm-hmm. It's because they're a company who actually does include a portion of their scope three emissions in their commitment. But, and this is a big but, their plan to reduce those emissions relies heavily on carbon offsets.
Womp, womp. We've heard this story before.
Well, get ready to hear it again, because carbon offsets or carbon neutrality is very different from zero emissions. And that difference will make or break our climate future.
Carbon neutrality means essentially a balancing of your carbon dioxide emissions with carbon credits, carbon offsets, and those can be emission reductions or removals. It doesn't really distinguish, but basically it means a balancing at any point.
That's Emma Watson. She works for the Science-Based Targets Initiative. Her organization helps set net zero standards for climate pledges, and they see a bunch of carbon offsets in companies' proposed commitments. I mean, a basic example is if a company emits 100 tons of carbon per year, they pay someone else to plant enough trees to balance out those tons of carbon emitted.
But of course, climate change is already decreasing the planet's natural methods for carbon absorption. I mean, planting trees does some good, to be sure, but as we've unfortunately witnessed, trees burn, and we obviously can't just buy more soil or ocean or atmosphere to bring back to Earth everything that we've put up into the skies.
The number one thing we need to be doing is stop burning fossil fuels. We don't have time for more excuses that push climate action further down the road.
And Emma told me there's a few things to look out for in pledges that aren't really about making climate progress.
So I think there are a few red flags, as you say. The first is when companies say we'll be net zero in our operations, because that tends to be a commitment that a company would make, and it's only covering, in the vast majority of cases, less than 20% of their actual footprint. So I think that's probably a number one red flag. I think also a lot of the time, a really super early date to achieve net zero is a red flag. Although we want to encourage ambition, we don't want that to be based on buying offsets. And really, what is required is pretty much a 90% reduction from companies. So if they're actually going to achieve that, they're not going to do it in the next 5 years most of the time.
Emma's job at SBTi is to standardize these net zero goals. Instead of companies just flinging out random reduction percentages, target dates, methods for getting there, and so on, she thinks there needs to be a common standard.
Net zero, I would say, is a bit of a wild west in terms of how companies are defining their approaches to net zero. They're looking at it from a whole lots of different lenses in many different ways. And since around about October 2018, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they came out with their special report on 1.5 degrees Celsius. And that was really when the concept of net zero started to gain popularity, and more companies were setting net zero targets, but without that structure, without that definition.
The lack of standardization is a big problem. It makes it really hard to understand what companies are even doing.
I think 3 years ago, we published our first progress report. And what we found was that a lot of companies weren't actually reporting in the way that they'd committed to. And that made it really hard for us to understand whether companies with science-based targets are actually doing what they've signed up to do.
We need to have pledges that can be measured. And Emma told me that the first thing we need to see in these pledges are short-term targets.
We're looking at a goal, I suppose. And with that goal, you need to have a near-term target. So you need to show that you're taking this short-term action, because we need to be halving our emissions by 2030. So that's the most important first step. The second part is that you have a long-term commitment. And for most companies, as I mentioned earlier, that's going to be a reduction of around 90%.
So we want these bold goals with strong, clear, short-term targets. This makes perfect sense to me. But the question I'm left holding is, what is it going to take to get more of these legitimate corporate pledges?
When it comes to climate action, there's one critical group that can directly influence a company. It's shareholders. And when you want shareholders to take a stand, you call someone like Louise Rouse, who we heard at the top of the show. Louise had to convince Shell's investors to push for climate action because she knew Shell itself never would.
I work as a consultant to nonprofit groups around the world to help them engage with the financial community on issues that concern them. We're trying to make NGOs as effective as possible within the finance sphere. So really trying to ensure that the fantastic work and research that they develop lands with this key stakeholder, because it's sort of painful to see when it doesn't, frankly, you know, that there's this great piece of research that has just not landed, has passed people by, they haven't seen it. And there is this sense that maybe if it was packaged slightly differently or delivered in it by a different messenger, that it would achieve greater impact. So that's, you know, really the mission is to help other groups, because I'm not a climate scientist. I'm not an expert on lots of the issues I work on, but I feel I have the ability to help message that work in a way that can make it as effective as possible.
Imagine the race to net zero is a relay. First up is a nonprofit like SBTI. They hit the ground running. They're standardizing goals and pushing for decarbonization. They're saying, look how hot this place is getting. Here's why, and here's how you can cool it down. Then they pass the baton to someone like Louise. Louise takes that climate science baton and repackages it into something a little different, something that will resonate with investors.
Well, investors ultimately are the owners of companies, and Milton Friedman's theory is that those companies owe their obligations to those investors, and shareholder return is the primary goal of management. But in theory, shareholders can direct management, they can appoint management, and so they do have the power ultimately to withdraw their money and their investment if they feel the company is not a good return for their money.
So this is one of a few levers shareholders have to influence a company, divestment. Divestment, at a large enough scale, scares management because it sends stock prices way down. And it's also galvanized media attention around corporate climate action.
I think both Shell and Exxon, if I remember correctly, have referenced the risk of divestment in the big range of risks that they're kind of legally obliged to disclose. They're having to spend a lot of time talking to shareholders, much more time than they would have spent 10 years ago, talking to people who are saying, it's becoming challenging for me to hold you. They are talking about the challenge for people to continue holding these stocks. So it's a very real thing.
It was big news when Harvard announced they'd start divesting their endowment portfolio away from fossil fuels. And they're not the only institutional investor taking this step. But it's not going to solve the problem on its own.
I mean, I imagine someone else just buys up those shares and the problem repeats, right?
Yeah, because now somebody who owns that stock, they might be less likely to use their shareholder power for climate action to actually make progress.
And so divestment might get us some decarbonized companies or decarbonized investment portfolios, but it's not going to get us all the way to a decarbonized economy.
I can sell any stock I hold in an oil company. That won't necessarily help the world decarbonize either. Now, that doesn't mean divestment doesn't have a very important role to play in changing the social license status of an industry. We would not have the movement we have in policy and regulation space without the divestment movement. But I think we would need to be cautious about investors dumping various companies and saying, that's it now, that's my climate work done, I have nothing else to do.
Luckily, there's another lever beyond divestment. It's called disclosure.
Disclosure is one of those terms we hear a lot in the climate space. But Pasha, what does it really mean and what is disclosure trying to achieve?
The core idea is that investors are legally entitled to information that'll allow them to understand risk and make smarter investment decisions.
Right. That's a focus of government regulatory agencies like the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC.
But in the past, climate data has not been part of that legally required information. But back in March, the SEC made a landmark proposal that would actually change this and would make it harder for companies to avoid disclosing their emissions and climate-related risks to investors. It is a big, big deal.
Wow, that is a big deal. It basically makes the SEC like a referee, right? They're saying, if you're a company and you're not disclosing your climate risks, your pollution, you could be penalized.
I mean, bring the pain, SEC.
But even though rules that require this kind of disclosure are definitely good, much like divestment, they're also not going to be enough.
There's a movie in the 90s, Jack Nicholson, called As Good As It Gets, and he is complaining to Greg Kinnear's character about something or other, and Greg Kinnear's character is giving him ineffective advice. And Jack Nicholson says, I'm drowning and you're describing the water. That is sort of my view about disclosure. There is an element that we know we're drowning and we're obsessed with describing the water and ensuring that the water is adequately described. And meanwhile, it continues to rise. Disclosure is a necessary but insufficient condition. So the danger is an over-reliance on disclosure as the mechanism by which you change the behavior of people in the market. And there's just way too much optimism that if the market has the information, then it will act on it. And I just don't believe disclosure or lack of disclosure is the primary reason why we're not seeing action on climate change. We're not seeing action on climate change because inaction is quite profitable. We're not seeing action on climate change because the financial system is fundamentally structured to be short-termist and so disincentivizes long-term thinking. Not only doesn't incentivize it, disincentivizes it.
Yeah, in the short term, climate inaction can be quite profitable for fossil fuel companies and their investors. The challenge is getting them to think longer term, and the financial system disincentivizes that.
Right, it's all about next quarter, next year, and it discourages the very kind of longer term thinking we need.
But things are changing. I mean, you saw what Louise did with Shell back in 2015. There are relative dark ages when it comes to all this stuff. More and more people, including investors, are waking up to climate change, which brings us to our third guest and a third lever for influencing corporations, engagement.
Engagements are reaching out to corporations, asking them for material information. If they respond, then we basically work with them in agreements over time. If they don't respond, then we escalate to what's called a resolution.
That's Jill Courtenay, a director at As You Sow, a shareholder advocacy nonprofit that pushes for climate action. She told me how engagement works with corporations in practice.
I've been working with As You Sow now for close to 4 years, and even a couple of years in, I didn't quite understand what we were doing. I was still learning. It's just, yeah. It's so involved and it's so detailed. And I was so surprised that a lot of the things that I had been reading about, like some of the changes that McDonald's was making with their plastics, things that Dunkin' Donuts was doing with their cups. And it's like all of these things related to plastics, all of these things related to pesticides, that a lot of the results that I was seeing and experiencing just as an everyday customer had actually started as a shareholder resolution.
Wow, that's really cool that shareholder resolutions are making such a difference. How does that actually work?
A shareholder resolution is basically a formal request. Shareholders can demand that management take action on an issue like climate. It's what you do if you've asked politely and a company still isn't making any changes. Because remember, many shareholders are part owners of a company because of the stocks that they hold. And that gives them important rights they can use to affect change.
And the first one is your right to request material information. And material information or materiality, it's any data that a shareholder needs to make a choice to buy, hold, or sell their shares. And voting your proxy is another right that you have as a shareholder.
This year, shareholders have submitted a record number of resolutions. Almost a quarter of those are about climate change. I mean, shareholders at Costco and Boeing voted in favor of resolutions asking management to report and take action on Scope 3 emissions, the beyond we were talking about before, all thanks to the work of organizations like As You Sow.
We're asking for and we want the ability to know and to document what the companies are committed to, what they've said they're committed to. Because company statements, they can say that they're doing all sorts of things. And without being behind the scenes, we really have no way of knowing. And so asking for material information is one of the first steps to holding them accountable. Because when we file resolutions or engagements, these become agreements that are in writing that we're actually holding them accountable to.
Resolutions aren't legally binding, but it would be a bad look for a company to overlook a resolution that gets a 20% vote in favor. I mean, they'd be flat out ignoring 1 in 5 of their shareholders, the very people they're supposed to make money for. And guess what? You and I and a lot of our listeners might already be those shareholders.
So most people who are participating in 401k plans through their companies or their workplace, they have very little idea of what's actually inside those mutual funds and if it's aligned with their values, either financially or otherwise. And that's 100 million shareholders that are in 401k plans. That's approximately $10 trillion of assets under management. That's a lot of money that has very little oversight.
Most of us are invested in the stock market through 401ks and mutual funds. But even if you've had $2,000 invested in an individual stock for 3 years or more, you have the right to vote and propose a resolution.
Okay, I am digging this newfound power, Pasha. And I like that it's sounding more political and more democratic than we might think about the financial space. But I'm wondering if we are running into the same problem we've touched on, that these resolutions are asking for better disclosure, better reporting, but we also know that's not enough.
In the story of corporate climate action, this is where policy comes in.
Oh, my favorite. You know I have a PhD in public policy, right?
It's now becoming very clear why Leah encouraged you to move to Santa Barbara, Pasha.
Remember the SEC proposal I talked about earlier? The one that would push companies to disclose their emissions and their climate risks?
The one that was announced back in March. But proposal seems like the key word here.
It is. But if the proposal is enacted, then everybody has to play by the same rules. The idea is that more investors will start investing in companies with better climate data and better decarbonization plans. Emma said it best when I spoke with her.
Not everyone's going to report on a voluntary basis for us to make the right decisions. So we need it to be mandatory and we need it to be done in the right way. So we very much welcome that the SEC coming through and hopefully we'll see more and more companies disclosing this information so we can make those right decisions.
Last spring, we got a peek into what these SEC rules might look like. In May, the SEC fined Bank of New York Mellon $1.5 million for implying that some of its funds met ESG investment criteria when they didn't.
And let's just do a quick definition shout out here. ESG, remember, that's everything environmental, social, and governance within a corporation.
So $1.5 million, that's kind of a slap on the wrist for a big bank, right? But it is also a precedent. It means that the SEC is not looking the other way anymore on blatant greenwashing. And hopefully, the same will be true for big companies if this disclosure rule passes.
Cracking down on greenwashing is absolutely a step forward, but it's not going to slash carbon pollution. We need to approach this from multiple political angles. Here's Louise again.
Ultimately, these are political issues that should be solved by regulation and policy. Rather than government's preference is for the market to solve this, and we don't need to get involved. And that is sort of the abdication we're having by politicians about climate change. We don't want to solve this. The market should solve this. And I think what you see is some market participants do not want that responsibility, and not necessarily for bad reasons, but they do not believe it is their role to be a regulator or to be a government.
The market has a pretty clear track record here. It's not going to drive voluntary pollution cuts. Too many players are still missing the big point. Climate change poses huge financial risks. Most investors and executives haven't factored that into their equations quite yet.
I think a lot of people don't think they're personally exposed. And by that, I mean their own professional lives are exposed. They're not measured on any metric that makes it relevant to them. Their bonuses are not dependent on it. And in fact, as I said, I think they're disincentivized from looking at it. And then it's a time frame of exposure. So I think they do still feel this is quite some way away. People who buy and sell actively, they believe they'll get off the train, you know, before that's their whole skill set, right? And they are ignoring, you know, the macroeconomic risk.
In other words, fancy algorithms and smart people who care about stock prices and returns are missing the forest for the trees.
And that's partially because for a lot of executives, their jobs and compensation depends on them not getting it. They're just not getting paid for climate progress.
That's why the push needs to continue to come from investors. Unlike most executives, they're thinking a little more long-term, especially institutional investors like public employee pensions. Louise pointed out the importance of big investors focusing on climate in particular.
The advantage that a financial actor has in that space is all of these sectors fall into their remit because they're investors across the economy. So they do have that cross-sectoral legitimacy that individual companies in those sectors might not feel that they have. And it would be good to see it being used.
We need investors and the SEC to cement climate disclosure as the norm and then move on to bigger political asks.
Because if you believe, for example, oil companies should not be undertaking new exploration, and you might be making that clearer to companies that you invest in, and you might even be considering leaving a company who's not agreeing with you, are you engaging with governments who are issuing licenses? Are you making clear as a major political stakeholder that you don't want that to happen? Because even if you don't hold a single oil company and governments continue to issue licenses and they continue to be drilled, then you're subject to the same risk as you were, with the exception of that particular stock performance. We need investors, for example, who are countering those who are calling up saying drill, 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 you know, and pushing for companies not to transition. That is happening. But we need them to be much more forceful and also to begin political engagement.
Investors can engage politically in two big ways. First, powerful investors can lobby the government directly for tighter regulations. And second, if investors know an executive is sympathetic to the cause, they can push that executive to lobby the government too.
I like it. It's a bit of a teamwork approach.
It is. Executives of companies and big investment firms meet with government officials multiple times a year to talk about policy. Climate risk could, and honestly should, just get rolled into those conversations.
Okay, so what's the holdup?
Well, the truth is, many corporate leaders don't think they should be pushing the government to do this. They're afraid of blowback from their conservative investors or even from their boards.
Yeah, there's a whole opposition movement going on. Republicans in red states are lining up to oppose what they call woke capitalism.
It sounds like the story you've brought us, Pasha, is that there are challenges and barriers everywhere we look, but also potential footholds for progress, and it's going to take leaders stepping into all of them.
Right, we've learned about divestment, disclosure, shareholder engagement and resolutions, lobbying, and ultimately changing the rules with policy. There's a lot that can be done.
It gives me some hope that we can make progress if investors, executives, and the government all do something to move us towards climate progress.
We know change can happen, even in the depths of the fossil fuel industry. And that's where I want to end today's episode, with perhaps the most famous battle, which happened at Exxon. Back in 2017, the company had refused to disclose information about what are called stranded assets, investments that might never pay off as the climate crisis grows and the world stops using oil.
And the shareholders agreed that the company was creating too much risk. Stranded assets, it means that they're pouring capital expenditures into searching for more oil and gas that would never be commercialized. It needed to stay underground because it was beyond the climate limits. And so we deemed that as a waste of money. So we got a majority vote, and still the company did nothing. So in 2018 and 2019, a group of shareholders voted no confidence on the board. Yet because there were no other board members running, even with low votes, the entire board stayed intact.
So Jill and her team, along with other shareholder advocates, took it up yet another level.
So in 2021, As You So worked on an initiative that brought a six-person board slate to Exxon and negotiated for three board seats. And then Engine One also ran a board slate for multiple seats. So we ended up with five new board members. Then Exxon offset this by increasing its board size from a 9-person board to a 12-person board, so it would still have the majority.
It was a big moment that shows the power shareholders can have. But Exxon fought back with a move of its own. They're fighting to keep control and keep polluting. Ultimately, this story may end in the courts.
So we're now suing seven oil and gas companies through what's called derivative action, where we actually represent the company and sue our own board for breach of fiduciary duty. That is what it has come to with the oil and gas companies.
Holding fossil fuel companies accountable is not simple. But with folks like Emma, Louise, and Jill leading the way, we have a chance. We now know when corporate plans are meaningless, but we also know what it would take to make them legitimate. Together, these advocacy groups are writing a new playbook for corporate accountability in the era of the climate crisis. And in the long run, I believe we are going to win.
A Matter of Degrees is co-hosted by me, Dr. Leah Stokes.
And me, Dr. Catherine Wilkinson. And this week, it's also hosted by...
me, Dr. Pasha Madavi.
We are a production made in partnership with Frequency Media, the 2035 Initiative at UC Santa Barbara, and the All We Can Save Project.
Thanks to our funders and supporters who make this show possible. Energy Foundation, Northlight Foundation, McKnight Foundation, Bloomberg Philanthropies, and the 11th Hour Project.
If you're digging the show, please hop on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and give us a 5-star rating or leave us a review.
Jordan Rizzieri is our producer. Catherine Devine and Emily Krumberger are our associate producers. Ina Garkusha is our supervising producer. And Michelle Corey is our executive producer.
William Cagle and Ellie Katz wrote the script. And Isabel Moncloa Daly and Becca Godwin were script editors. Matthew Ernest Filler is our lead audio engineer, mixer, and sound designer, with dialogue editing and additional mixing by Claire Bidigari Curtis.
Rose Wong designed our new show art, and Sean Marquand composed our theme song. Additional music came from Blue Dot Sessions.
Research, fact-checking, communication, and production support by Daniela Schulman, Amarachi Metu, Jenna Cameron, and Madeline Jubilee Saito.
Come back soon as we tell more stories for the climate curious.